From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment Arts Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state. You can listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or ask your smart speaker to play SDPB. And you can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to our In the Moment Segments podcast. Now here's your weekly roundup in arts coverage.
During the centennial year of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, which assured that women in the United States have the right to vote, SDPB has embarked on a project to tell the history of suffrage in South Dakota. The battle for women's suffrage in the United States was complex, controversial, and sometimes built on division instead of solidarity. Lori was joined by a historian to help tell this story.
Today we welcome Sarah Egge. She's Associate Professor of History at Center College in Kentucky. She's originally from South Dakota, and she's a contributor to the book Equality at the Ballot Box, Votes for Women on the Northern Great Plains. She's also author of the book Woman Suffrage and Citizenship in the Midwest, 1870 to 1920. Professor Egge, welcome. Thank you for being here.
I'm glad to be here.
Take me back a little bit and tell me how long you've been interested in this particular area of history as a point of study.
Sure. So I got interested actually as an undergraduate. I took a course on women's history, and what fascinated me most was that there was really nothing in the scholarly record about women's suffrage in the Midwest, in particular among rural Americans. And so that really struck me as an absence. And considering I'm from South Dakota, I grew up with really strong women in my family and just had all these examples of women who fought for what they knew was right. And so I was unconvinced that there was nothing to say about women's suffrage in the Midwest or in rural America. And so that's really where I started. And I continued to pursue that in graduate school, and I've been doing so ever since as a professor.
Yeah, that must have been frustrating in the sense of, you know, why does this not matter to other people? And then also exhilarating in the sense that says, I might be the person to do this. So there's a project laid out in front of me. Let's talk about, I want to go to your chapter in this book, Equality at the Ballot Box, because it's about ethnicity and women's suffrage. And so much of what our national dialogue right now is about systemic racism and the foundations of enslavement and the legacy of that in America and immigration. And we want to look back at history and say that there's people, you know, that we can just get behind as, you know, 100%, you know, pure or good or perfect. And those are the women who got the right to vote. But of course, it's far more complicated than that. Lay the groundwork here for a little bit on what some of this, you know, inclusion and division was about here on the Great Plains.
Yeah, so just as you said, uncovering this history, one of the things that struck me that no one had really talked about extensively was just how important ethnicity was to the fight in on the Great Plains and in the Midwest when it came to women's suffrage. One of the biggest issues was that people were trying to pass amendment campaigns in the late 19th century in this place that also was seeing a tremendous amount of immigration from mainly northern European countries. And if you look around South Dakota today, it reflects this. We have lots of people with German ancestry, Norwegian or Swedish, Danish ancestry, lots of Scandinavian. And so these immigrant groups were really important to understanding then how women were supposed to ask and demand for the right to vote, because one of the interesting things that South Dakota has, and lots of states actually at this time also have this, is a practice that allows foreigners to vote before they become citizens. It's referred to a number of different things, declarant suffrage or alien suffrage. This is, a common practice in the late 19th century that gives the right to vote to people who have declared their intention to become citizens. And at the time, that was after 2 years of living in a particular place or state. And that was before the five-year residency requirement that allowed you to then petition to become a citizen. So for women in South Dakota and lots of states like this, this is really sort of a stark contrast. Here they are. They are native-born citizens with birthright citizenship that's enshrined in the 14th Amendment. And they are looking around them at a sea of these immigrants who are not citizens, and they can vote. And so that's something that I really try to bring out, that in this particular context, immigration and ethnic identity was a critical component to the ways in which then women and these suffragists made their case for why they should have the right to vote.
So do they have to campaign or make their case to different groups in different ways then? Is that sort of like a messaging problem that they have or a challenge?
Oh, it's definitely challenging because on the one hand, there's a growing sense of nativism, not just in South Dakota and other places in the Midwest, but also nationally. It's pretty small in the late 19th century, but it grows quite quickly, and certainly by World War One, that becomes a major issue. But what it requires these suffragists to do, because these are voters, after all, these ethnic groups, they have to reach out to them. And one of the big divides then is between national suffrage leaders, people like Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Carrie Chapman Catt, and state and local suffragists. These national leaders really struggle to reach the ethnic voters. They find this to be really a problem. They're not translating materials into native languages of these immigrants. They're struggling to find lecturers. And so it becomes a real problem for them as they're trying to figure out what message. And the other thing, frankly, for these immigrants, a lot of them are not very excited, frankly, about women voting. So it becomes a real obstacle for people living in South Dakota trying to get the right to vote for women. How do you reach a population that the national leaders are increasingly start to write off at the same time knowing that they're voters, right? And then probably the final issue is temperance, which was tied so tightly to women's suffrage. And for a lot of ethnic voters, they did not want women to have the right to vote because they wanted to continue to drink alcohol, which was a major part of their cultural identities.
Mm-hmm. And so that becomes, something that plays out how? I mean, are they sort of blocked from even speaking to these groups? Are they just voting against them? How do some of those dynamics unfold?
So I talk about this in my work. What they have to do is be kind of creative. So a lot of the state and local leaders will kind of work alongside, but then kind of go off on their own away from what the national leaders are doing. They'll take their messages to these immigrant communities. And a lot of these immigrant communities are in sort of these ethnic enclaves. They're away from the railroads at this time. They're not necessarily living in the biggest cities or towns in South Dakota. And so they're going to schoolhouses and they're going to churches and they're trying desperately to convince these immigrant neighbors to support the cause. But again, it's really tricky because a lot of these immigrants are wary. They don't believe that these suffragists are going to, at least what they say, that they're going to actually just vote on particular issues and they're going to stay away from temperance. And in part, it's difficult in South Dakota because the state association at the time, especially in the late 19th century, the leadership of the state association was the same as the Women's Christian Temperance Union, or the WCTU. So they might make promises, but the fact that they had this overlapping leadership was, at least for these immigrants, a clear sign that they were going to vote for, as they say, the rum power out. So it gets really complicated for them. Honestly, it really tangles them up into knots until the 20th century when a new group of state leaders emerges, the South Dakota Universal Franchise League, led by a woman named Mamie Pyle from Huron. And she explicitly has no ties, at least on the surface, to temperance. And that really allows these suffragists to make women's suffrage a single issue.
Yeah. Sometimes I just have to pause a little bit and think about how people are choosing between the right for someone to vote and their right to drink. And it makes you look at contemporary politics again with a fresh look. And I want to talk about that a little bit because, we're still having these conversations today about our leaders and the people we admire from history. And how do you as a historian look back and say, I'm not going to make excuses, for any behavior but I want to see who these people were in their fullness of the kinds of conversations they had, the kinds of decisions that they made. How do you approach that as a historian?
Yeah, so that's one of the keys to the discipline, frankly. It's the thing that I try to do the most often, is to take away my potential biases, my ideas about what they should have done, and really look at why they did what they did. And what that forces me to do is really look at the context. So what were the range of decisions in front of them? And so for a lot of these groups, it does, if you kind of look at it on the surface, you're thinking, you know, these groups just wanted alcohol and they then didn't support women's suffrage. But I think it actually goes deeper than that. For a lot of them, consuming alcohol was central to their ethnic celebrations. On Sundays, for example, lots of Germans in South Dakota and other Midwestern states would get together. They would speak in German. They would go to church and they would hear German. And then they would have a pint or two. And it wasn't necessarily that alcohol was the key, but it was part of an affirmation of who they were. And even though they had left their old country and their families back there, they could at least bring up those memories in really powerful ways. And so for them, then, women's suffrage was part of a broader effort to erase their cultural identities, to force them to assimilate. And one of the things that a lot of immigrants in South Dakota at the time did not want was to lose that ethnic identity. It was really important to a lot of them. And so I think when I look at that now, I can still see that in a lot of the celebrations that South Dakota has even today. A lot of them are built on these ethnic and racial identities.
Yeah. How did all this intersect with Indigenous women and suffrage for them? And we have 2 minutes to talk about that. So give me a little intro there, because obviously we don't have enough time to get fully into it.
Yeah, well, and so one of the things that is unfortunate here is that while there were lots of Indigenous women who did support women's right to vote, and they were certainly part of cultures that afforded women more rights and more power in their particular positions, unfortunately, a lot of suffragists basically discounted Indigenous women and their participation. They saw them as maybe sort of secondary or even sort of on the margins of the group. They would recall them. I've seen them sort of, they're brought up as sort of examples or tokens of, look at these women, they support women's suffrage, but they were never central to the movement. And in part, it's because the national and state leaders didn't see them that way. It's unfortunate that, again, as you said, systems of race and ideas of race perpetuated inequalities even within the suffrage movement.
As you heard, the right to vote changed American history forever. And as we look back at efforts to give women that right, we're also spending time getting to know South Dakota women who have stood on the shoulders of those early giants and opened the door wider for other women as well. This week we talked with Stephanie Hursa Sandlin.
Today, we welcome Stephanie Herseth Sandlin. She grew up on the family farm in South Dakota and received undergraduate, graduate, and law degrees from Georgetown University. In 2002, she became the first executive director of the South Dakota Farmers Union Foundation, and she was the first woman from South Dakota elected to the U.S. House of Representatives, where she served from 2004 to 2011. And on September 15, 2017, she was inaugurated as Augustana University's 24th president. She joins us now on the phone. Stephanie Hursa Sandlin, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lori. An honor to be with you today, particularly on this really important historical topic that has ongoing impacts for women today.
There are so many women that we have talked to about this who have either, you know, at some point in their professional career, stumbled upon something that made them realize how important this history was, or who have kind of spent an entire career ignoring it and are now thinking more deeply about what that time meant and 100 years later, what it means for us now. And I'm wondering where you're at on that trajectory. Was there a time at Georgetown or before then in high school where you kind of realized that this particular thread of American history impacted you? It was personal.
I would say for a lot of us, it happens in college. And I remember distinctly the classroom I was sitting in college when I took a course on women in the law. And what I'm reminded of is just how recent this history is. I mean, my grandmother, Lorna Hursa, who is one of my most significant role models, was born 10 years before women had the right to vote. And then she was elected to a local office in 1936 and 1938 in the Depression. So here, you know, less than 20 years after women had the right to vote, and she was seeking public office before she was married to my grandfather. And then as I sat in that college course and was learning about recent Supreme Court cases addressing rights of women in the workplace, it just really struck me by how recent all of this was, that women were getting more opportunities. And I'm struck that while I think each generation, it takes a bit longer in one's life maybe to experience some of the barriers that are still there, and that's what we have to continue to work on and make progress on for each generation going forward. But I think for a lot of us, it may be the first time we encounter a barrier. I think for me, it was just my interest in the law, my interest in policy, and a lot of what I learned in that particular course during my junior year of college.
Yeah, because when you think, you know, being the first woman to represent South Dakota in the U.S. House of Representatives, hey, 2004, that's the 21st century. It seems like that's kind of late to the game as well. Or the first woman president of Augustana University in 2017. There are new things yet to be done still.
Unfortunately, there are still a number of firsts that women are still working and striving to achieve. And yet the more that we achieve them, the more that we celebrate them and each other, the more that we then use these positions that we earn and we work toward, knowing that we've had so much support from so many other men and women along the way, then we can use our spheres of influence in a way that continue to push forward for progress for other women, with trying to be always cognizant that in doing so, we're not unintentionally putting up barriers to others, you know, that we're trying to make progress without inhibiting or repeating some of the mistakes of the past. And I'm heartened with a lot of the progress that we're seeing. And I'm inspired every day by young women at Augustana who are our students there who have big dreams and work so hard and are so talented. So I'm so glad we're having these opportunities for reflection and thinking about history and both our past as well as our present.
We just had a conversation with one of the 2020 Bush Fellows, an Indigenous woman from South Dakota, who said she wanted to be a university president, and it was Barry Dunn who told her at SDSU, yeah, you could do that. So talk, were there people who said that to you, who said to you, yeah, you can make it here, or yes, you could really do that? Who are some of those people who just affirmed or validated a pathway for you that turned out to be really influential?
Well, it starts, I think, in our very young years. I mean, before I speak specifically to being a female president, you know, my mom was of a generation where, again, you know, women were starting to enter and get more opportunities in the workplace. And she, when people would ask me what I might want to be. And then she would talk to me later because she felt some of my responses were maybe limiting. And she wanted me to think more expansively of the things that maybe I would want to be when I grew up. And then it was my mom who was the most encouraging when I decided to run for Congress in 2002. And she wasn't the political side of the family. She wasn't raised into that. She married into it when she married my dad, but she believed in me, but I think also was a voice of her generation of women who wanted to empower and knew that certain doors were open maybe to her daughter and those of her daughter's generation that weren't open to her and her friends. And then I think, you know, for more women, we have to find ways then to expose women to what these professional endeavors and what these professional responsibilities look like and what are some of the more traditional or non-traditional pathways. My pathway to becoming a university president was not what one would consider a traditional pathway. It might have been back when I was in my 20s and wanted to be a college professor and was laying the groundwork to do that. If I had done that and then worked, spent years teaching, becoming a member of the administration in a university, and then seeking a presidency. But more and more are coming in non-traditional pathways outside of higher education. But I think the more young women see women in certain roles and think, I wonder what it would be like, and what did that person do? That's where it comes back to our storytelling. My grandmother, Lorna, was a wonderful storyteller. My aunt, Connie Jacobs, inherited that wonderful ability to tell stories. But again, with what you're doing today and with other women across the state that you're interviewing, with the great work of the project to recognize women's suffrage and the interviews that are happening to capture those stories in the archives and the history of the state, the work of the South Dakota Hall of Fame and capturing stories of men and women alike, I think that helps. And then when we spend deliberate time with young women to talk about our journey, about some of the hardships in those journeys, but also the things that we took advantage of, if we had advantages that we saw, or how we overcame certain barriers, or how we built coalitions, or how we had relationships that helped us along the way.
When we look at the history of suffrage, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Lori. I was just going to say, in terms of the university president, I remember being contacted that someone had nominated me, and I found out after the fact it was the first intern that I had hired at Raven Industries, Thad Tietze, who's finished law school down in Vermilion at USD. And I remember getting contacted thinking I was flattered, but I didn't know if I could do the job. I didn't know what the board was looking for. But then I think, again, others who encouraged me, my husband in particular, and then a few other people, I think you have to be open and confident in your abilities and be open to what it might take, and knowing your value and being able to articulate the value of your other experiences when you're aspiring to additional leadership positions, like when I was nominated by Thad to be the president of Augustana University.
Yeah, I wonder for women how many times it is somebody coming from the outside and seeing something in you, and how many women say, am I qualified for that? Could I do? And then they do the self-examination and the self-reflection. But often it's from somebody else who says, I see this in you. I think that you're a great candidate. How do you overcome that, that hesitation or that doubt? I mean, before I started this job, I did print journalism and interviewed dozens, maybe hundreds even, of women. And I almost always got a no the first time I asked them because they didn't think they were worthy of a profile. And then you would come back and say, I think this is why we want to do it. Okay, I guess. So in our remaining 2 minutes, like how do women overcome? Because in my experience as a reporter, that was a uniquely female response. How do you overcome that moment of hesitation and step into something to really go to that new place?
Such a good question, Lori. And it's just, I think it's how women continue to be socialized. And I don't say that to be hypercritical. I say it so that all of us as women and men can be more deep in our awareness and understanding of how we're socializing our daughters and our granddaughters. And that we have conversations earlier and we're more keen on what it is we're communicating to them at very early ages. But I think also recognizing that this will take time, and that if we're more focused on it, about what we're communicating, and we keep knowing that women just need that additional encouragement, but again, to recognize one's value, what one may be able to do, to aspire, to encourage big dreams, to encourage going after aspirational goals. But it's upon all of us, whether we're moms or stepmoms, grandmas, aunts, we need to be thinking and being very deliberate in our conversations with the young girls and young women in our lives.
South Dakota continues to fight for social justice in a number of arenas, and this week SDPB's Kevin Wooster has been contemplating the message of music and the role of religion in seeking justice. Enjoy.
Hey, Kevin, welcome back.
It's always good to be back, Lori.
We were talking yesterday with the Dakota Political Junkies about the festivities tomorrow and, well, starting kicking up right now in the Black Hills. And I was talking about how much I dislike traffic. So what's your plan for the weekend? Are you going to hide away from any additional traffic, or are you going out seeking a little Independence Day adventure?
Well, first, I love Traffic, the group with Steve Winwood, and that was kind of one of the people back with Crosby, Stills, and Nash. I want to make sure that we weren't missing Traffic, the music of Traffic, as opposed to the traffic mess we're going to have here. But I'm not going anywhere near Rushmore for this period. I probably wouldn't normally. I think you and I have talked that I've only seen one fireworks display in person, sort of, and that was actually from the top of Black Oak Peak. So unlike most people who look up at the fireworks over Mount Rushmore, I looked down on it, and I enjoyed that. I thought it put everything in perspective pretty well that night. Certainly not putting it down, but we probably also talked about the fact that in about 5 minutes, I'm done with fireworks. So if it's a 20-minute display, 15 minutes of it is me going, okay, can we leave? So that's that. And Seth, great story by Seth.
I didn't start liking fireworks. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to SDPB Radio. This is In the Moment. My guest is Kevin Wooster. Oh, you're still there. Good. All right. I was going to say, I didn't start liking fireworks at all until I was a parent. Yeah, well, one of those magical delays, but we're still together.
Yeah.
I was one of those kids who would cry every time. All right, Kevin, let's talk a little bit about your blog post. Let's see if we can make this work here.
Okay, am I still here?
You are still here. Tell us a little bit about some of your early experiences. I'm going to let you talk for a few minutes so we can work this out. You're writing a little bit about music and some early memories, and then we'll jump to present time. Go.
Well, me talk for a few minutes, that's hard to imagine. I'm usually at a loss for words. But it's one of those things, as you know, if you're writing, you start thinking about things going on, and I've struggled with how to write anything about what's going on today in race relations and, hopefully policing reform in certain areas and those kind of things. And somehow I ended up back on the beach by Chamberlain with a bonfire and a teenage girl. I was a teenager then, and talking about music. And you know what happens, you're struggling to find an inroad, a way to enter a story that's difficult or a subject matter that's difficult, and suddenly you slip into it. And that sometimes for some of us as we get older, slipping into it is easier if it's decades ago rather than right now. And so that was the entry point for this. Also the idea that we had this conversation, this very nice young woman and I, and disagreed over whose band we liked best or which kind of music we liked best. And one of the things she said was she didn't care for some of the music I listened to because it made you think too much, and she just wanted to listen to the music. Mm-hmm. And we had a conversation, and I think that's kind of the way the whole blog column took off. And then it took shape, really, while I was sitting in Mass yesterday with Father Ed Witt, the Jesuit priest up in the North Rapid Parish that serves primarily Native people. There are plenty of non-Natives that go there too, including my wife and I, and the prophet Amos. So from there, all things started to blend, I guess.
Yeah, and we've been talking a lot this week about Mount Rushmore and, racism in America and, statuary and sculptures. And one of the themes that comes across is that moment of what do we allow make us think? How do we process that time? It's not necessarily a bad thing to sit and look at the complexities of something. It's not necessarily something to run away from, is it?
No, and my guess is you know, the young woman that I was with, she was probably in a good place of development, you know, working her way into adulthood. And I thought I was maybe smarter and older and more mature and wiser than I really was at that time. And but sitting with Father Ed, who's one of those guys that takes the scripture and brings it, boom, into your daily life and hits you right in the face with it and says, okay, what are you going to do about this? And whether that's climate change or whether it's racism or whether it's dealing, you know, in some positive, helpful way with the homeless issues and things. And that's what he did there with a scripture reading from Amos about justice. And, you know, Ed is always talking about the core of our faith has to be a love of goodness and a love of right and a love of justice as well as a love of God. And that kind of gets you going on. It got me from there to, it happened to be Amos as his particular scripture reading by Amos was a favorite of Martin Luther King's and the importance of fighting for justice. And as you and I know, Martin Luther King did that in a nonviolent way, but not in a peaceful way always. And in said, as I said in the column, that sometimes it can't be done without a certain amount of civil disobedience and uproar.
I want to talk to you about Amos here a little bit, but first it occurs to me, and I very rarely speak for all women, Kevin, but there is a possibility that you might have, not considered, which is how often women are told by wise men what music they should like. And maybe she liked your music just fine, and she just didn't like you and the way you were. If I downloaded in the history of my life, every time a well-meaning fella told me I should really like this band better than the one that I liked, I don't know. It's kind of a thing.
Well, and here's the funny thing. I like Chicago better now than I did when I was 18. And so, I mean, who was the wise person then, me or her? I don't know. I know that I was judgmental. I was often judgmental and difficult, and I think she was probably a nicer person than I was. Maybe smarter, too.
Who's to say? but I sent you a link this morning because yesterday I was listening to this piece on Here and Now about that Tom Gelton did about the history of racism in organized religion. And this idea that for some people there's this unforgivable failing of white supremacy in the church. When you're challenged by the words of Amos or challenged by something you hear in Mass, how do you also kind of look at this history of religious oppression of indigenous people or things that organized religion has done that are shameful?
Some people ask me when they mention, for example, the Catholic Church and the priest abuse things, the vast majority of which was decades ago, but still horrible and must be addressed and continuing, and those kinds of things. And again, the racism that was expressed in some, and I don't know, maybe many Christian denominations or at least churches. I use the nation comparison. The United States of America is a horribly imperfect nation. We did evil things. We still do evil things. We're trying to get better all the time, and I don't leave my church because it failed and had evil moments or evil periods any more than I leave my country because of that. And we have to stay, I believe, not everyone has to do this myself the way I do, but I believe I stay with the church I love and in my very small way try to make it a better place. And there are certainly many people in that church that have tried to do that, the Jesuits among them, and I continue to try. Just like there are many people in this country, it's the same fight, you know, that we're fighting to not be such bad versions of ourselves. And right now, I think we have one of those opportunities that came around in the 60s and has come around periodically and is here again. And I think what Father Ed was saying through Amos yesterday is, let's take advantage of this. Let's not miss this opportunity because something makes us uncomfortable. I get uncomfortable. We talked about the statue issues. I don't like it when people destroy public property. I don't like it when they destroy pieces of history. I think we should go through a process if we decide as a public, not as a mob or as a crowd, that we should destroy something or take it down or put it in a museum. We decide that as a public, not as a bunch of people with spray paint and hammers. And so I don't like that. But that's part of the process we're going through, too, discomfort.
Yeah, right. The willingness to be uncomfortable and to take action based on that discomfort. By the way, I like Crosby, Stills and Nash better than Chicago as well. But I really prefer Neil Young. of all the options on the table, I'd pick Neil Young any day.
and he was there too, you know, when he was functional. He was very important to Crosby, Stills and Nash.
What is the for people who don't know who Amos is in our remaining minute? What is this? Who is this prophet, and what is he telling us to consider?
Well, one of the things I love this, because this is one of the readings, and Father Ed loves this too, where he's considered a minor prophet. I'm never quite sure what that is, you know, but he's pretty major in this area. But he talks about spurning your feasts and your solemnities and your cereal offerings and your stall-fed peace offerings and your noisy songs and your melodies of the harp. What he wants is burnt offerings that let justice surge like water and goodness like the unfailing stream. And that's the call that Martin Luther King gave through Amos. That's the call Father Ed gave yesterday through Amos. I think in many ways that's the call Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young have given in one way or another, and it's a call we should listen to.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. If you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh, Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.